Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. This week in Arkansas, lovers of the performing arts have an embarrassment of riches to choose from, two of which are in Conway. But with luck, good planning, fine weather and time, it should be able to savor both. A new play by Lee Blessing, award-winning playwright, commissioned by Hendrix Theatre Arts, and an acclaimed opera singer at UCA, in town as artist in residence. Suzanne Mensah is featured on the second part of today's program. Lee Blessing, born and educated in Minneapolis, completed his BA degree at Reed College in Oregon, following which he took up his parents' offer of a trip to Russia. This led to his first and best-known work, A Walk in the Woods. With an impressive and varied list of plays and awards since, and active as a teacher, he is currently head of the graduate playwriting program at Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University. So, not surprisingly, the choice. When Danny Grace, professor of design at Hendrix College Department of Theatre and Dance, was looking to commission a play for his department. So, Lee Blessing is my first guest today to talk about the Hourglass Project. I wondered if it falls into the category of fantasy and whether this is your first attempt at fantasy in playwriting.
Well, certainly it's fantasy in the sense that it's based on a technological evolution that we haven't reached yet as a species, genetic techniques that might reverse the effects of aging. But certainly a place we're aiming towards as humans. We're always trying to expand lifespan. And this is another aspect of that. So given that the play takes place somewhat in the future and is about a speculative topic, very much so. It allows me to look at the whole thing, not as much from a nuts and bolts, how would it happen, how could point of view as, well, given that it did happen, how is it affecting people emotionally?
Then had you been playing with something like this for a while?
No, actually, the concept for the play came out of the commission. You know, when I first took the commission, I said, what sort of play are you guys looking for? And they said, well, you know, anything you want to write. But it would be, you know, wonderful if it had a large-ish cast because we're a college, and also because we're a college, it would be great if most of the characters, many of the characters, could be people who can believably be played by undergraduates. And so I challenged myself to come up with a play which, as it stands now, has 9 roles, all of whom are 20 years old, and yet make it not a standard group of such people. And in this case, these are people who are, many of these people are 20 years old, but actually they've already lived full lifetimes. They've lived to 80 before they were, underwent a process to make them physically 20 again.
But the 20-year-olds that you have in your play are still somewhat fixed in their old attitudes.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I was fascinated by was, let's say, the play posits that you can return a person physically to the age of 20. But it doesn't really speak to where they are emotionally and experientially. They still have lived 80 years. They still have those memories. They still have that perspective on life. How then, you know, do they operate in this new young body that they have? What do they think is important now? You know, they're not going to look at the way the world the way a normal 20-year-old does because they've gone through too much.
Well, one or two of them are quite happy to start over and become a celebrity and make a lot of money, which is a very normal everyday life from beginning to at least to middle age. By age, you're getting to the point where you realize there's not much chance of making it. But there's a certain amount of anger in the characters. They're not happy with being made over. And one or two of them are willing to speak it out. I mean, Abby and Don are not a particularly comfortable couple. She finally is being allowed in her new guise to give voice to some of her hang-ups from when she was 80. And I wondered, when you started the play, did you have the shape of it in your mind, or did it sort of develop as you wrote?
Well, I think as with a number of my plays, it evolved through a number of revisions. I think I always knew I wanted to place it on an island. I wanted this to be a private experiment, not a public experiment, not a government experiment, but, you know, an experiment that was funded by wealthy individuals who then sort of kept everything close to the vest. This is a secret experiment, basically, and so these people are sequestered on an island. As they adjust to their new bodies and a new situation, those kinds of principles about the play, I think I established early.
Yeah.
As I was writing it. And it allows me to concentrate on, the fact is that different people would respond to something like this in different ways. Some are absolutely exhilarated and delighted, and others, interestingly to me, anyway, emotionally, they've become much more introspective. They're, if anything, more anxious. suddenly they have another future that they didn't expect was out there. The one pair of them who were a married couple when the experiment began, as you say, Abby is very nervous about suddenly being 20 and married again to this guy, and whereas Don is simply, can hardly wait to use his new body for marital relations. And, of course, that creates a bit of an amusing problem. And then, just the fundamental questions such as, are they still married?
Yes.
The law doesn't really cover this sort of new situation. Fundamentally, existentially, do they feel married? Is this the equivalent of death, having been reset this way?
Mm-hmm.
So some moral and legal questions start to arise.
And then is it Melissa who's had such tragedies and concerns and just doesn't want to relive them and can't bear the thought of living her life over again?
Yeah, there's a spectrum of reactions that these people display, and she's on the far side of that spectrum. She's suicidal. That's her first impulse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want to have to live 60 more years suddenly. So anything I could find, I think, that in terms of reactions that could open up new questions and make us or present new aspects of the situation, the problem, or the philosophical question involved, was interesting to me.
But as I read further into it, I began to think, now, where's he going with this? How can he make this come to life in a different, more solid way? And I wondered, when you said they were all 20, having been 80, isn't Steve the only one who actually is 20?
Steve and Dana.
Yeah,
yes. The wealthy individuals who have set up the program is the highly educated daughter who is sort of running and managing it on the ground.
She's a true scientist and is prepared to go along with her parents until suddenly things change. And you realize how...
She discovers a few things.
Yeah, yeah. And when she realizes that her parents, they may be scientists, but they're so dedicated to what they're doing, it's all an amoral fantasy. They don't care who they're treating for this, and they're quite happy to dispose of them if they feel that it's going to lose its secrecy.
Well, this is the problem with the secret experiment. The people who control it have perhaps a little too much power, and what she discovers is that her parents are rather arrogant when it comes to the fate of these particular test subjects. As far as they were concerned, they're just trying to establish the science and the technique as repeatable. Once that's done, they don't really care about the pioneering subjects.
And they're quite happy to dispose of them if they feel that it's not behaving quite the way they should intend them. It's like children with a doll or a toy
that they'll break it if it doesn't work. It's a cleaner situation if they just can dispose of these people.
Yeah. But the setting and its environment, its problems that arise, did these colorful aspects of the privacy, the secrecy, come to you as you wrote, and you just must have had rather a lot of fun devising them?
It's you know, it was fun being able to take these people and put them on a relatively Edenic island, perhaps somewhere in the warm southern part of the country, you know, completely isolated. Also, it helps if you're writing in the future to have this sort of a location, because you don't have to invent what cars of the future look like.
And hideous shrieks and all kinds of things.
The natural world should sound a little more comforting than it does in this play.
Yes, and it sort of ties in with Robinson Crusoe and things that you don't know what's in the environment, what's out there.
Also reminds us that as we evolve, as we develop, experimentally, move into new and fascinating sorts of technologies, and you know, we're also moving into a kind of wilderness. Mm-hmm. Especially a moral wilderness. It's going to present questions we've never contemplated before.
Then, having created this elixir of youth that Dana's parents had come up with, the fact that this actually did work, shock as she realized what this whole thing was developing into, because she still had the inbred approach to science that she had had all her life as something worth pursuing and would be for the good of mankind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a prisoner of the presumption that scientific progress is amoral sort of thing, that we simply learn to do what we have the potential to learn to do. But I think that one of the things that play suggests is that different, you know, areas of science get explored for different reasons. Since it all costs money, whoever supplying that money is making the decisions about what will we look into, why do we want to look into it, and what will we do once we gain new scientific knowledge and technical expertise.
Then you come to the end of the play, which is an open ending. To my mind, Dana ends up as the only one left. She doesn't trust anybody anymore, does she?
No, she loses her innocence, I think, in this play. The play presents some knotty problems. Even as it's funny and a bit fantastical, it is a play that keeps bringing us back to difficult choices and big question marks. It's a new technology, and once you gain a new technology, establish new scientific principles, they don't go away again. They are creating something for relatively narrow reasons that's going to have world-changing potential. What are the social changes that would arise if this technology became widely available?
You've obviously created your own world with a lot of humor in it on the part of the playwright. Maybe not quite so funny for the people who are actually in the play.
Well, it's nice writing about something that may happen in the future. I can enjoy the humor of it. If and when it happens, it could be grim.
That was Lee Blessing, whose play, The Hourglass Project, was commissioned by the Hendrix College Theatre Arts and Dance Department, with support from the Hendrix Murphy Foundation. It receives its premiere performance 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, March the 5th, and runs through March the 8th, 7:30 Wednesday through Friday, Saturday at 2 p.m. in the Cabe Theatre. Free admission, reservations suggested. Lee Blessing will be in town for the opening night. Call 501-450-1343 or visit online www.hendrix.edu/theaterarts. Also at Hendrix on March the 4th, 7:30 in the Mill Center, a talk by visiting Professor Seth Jeppesen on a parody of cults in Roman comedy. At UCA March the 3rd, don't miss the public appearances event, the Haifa Symphony from Israel, 7:30 in Reynolds Performance Hall. In Jonesboro March 3rd through 5th, Arkansas State University presents Steel Magnolias, 7:30 in the Fowler Center. Then March the 4th at Arkansas State University Mountain Home, catch Nebraska Theater Caravan with The Fantastics, 7 p.m. in the Vada Shield Community Center. In Fayetteville, March the 6th, hear the Soweto Gospel Choir in the Walton Arts Center, where March the 7th, Roseanne Cash takes the Baumwalker Hall stage. And in the Nadine Baum Studio Theater, Theater Squared's production Good People continues through March the 9th, the final performance.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Central Arkansas. This afternoon at 3, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra performs Verdi's Requiem at Robinson Center Music Hall, featuring 4 soloists and 7 local choirs. Students in kindergarten through 12th grade can get a free ticket with a ticketed adult by contacting the symphony. At UALR this afternoon, Artspree presents the Chinese Folk Music Orchestra from Tsingtao University, 3 p.m. at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. Opening this week at the Arkansas Rep, Les Miserables. Pay What You Can night is Wednesday, and the official opening night is Friday. Opening Friday at the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Shows Fridays at 7 and Saturdays and Sundays at 2 through March 28th. Opening at Weekend Theater, The Water Children. Shows Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 through March 22nd. Next weekend, the Arkansas Symphony presents The Wizard of Oz, a screening of the 1939 classic film with accompaniment by the orchestra, this Saturday at 8 and next Sunday at 3. And next Sunday at the Arkansas Art Center, a Friends of Contemporary Craft conversation with class artist Ed Pennebaker. On display around town, just opened at the Arkansas Art Center, The Crossroads of Memory, Carol Clore and the American South. Also on display, Ties That Bind, Southern Art from the Collection. At the Arkansas Studies Institute, Unusual Portraits, new works by Michael Warwick and David O'Brien, and Native Arkansas. And at the UALR Galleries, Say It With a Snap, Motivating Workers by Design, 1923-1929, and Primary Clay. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
I was made fun of a lot by the kids at school, and I didn't understand where I fit in. And when I saw the opera, I thought, oh, my gosh, that's actually what my voice is meant to do. That was really what kind of, it didn't even turn me on that I liked the art form as much as that I had a loud voice.
Suzanne Mensah, whose mezzo-soprano voice took her to the great opera houses in the world, on stage with legendary singers and conductors. She will be in Conway at the University of Central Arkansas in residence March 5th through 7th, sponsored by the College of Fine Arts and Communications Artist in Residency Program. She will be joined by Luis Menendez, acclaimed collaborative pianist and vocal coach, and until recently, resident in Arkansas. Suzanne Mensah herself now lives in California and has a vocal studio in San Francisco. For several years, she was on the faculties of first DePaul University and latterly Rice University Shepherd School of Music, but is returning to opera, including in the fall, New York's Metropolitan. While in Conway, she and Menendez will give masterclasses and a recital of songs by women composers. Reached by phone in California last Monday, she told of some of the things that came her way. First born in Philadelphia, moved to Maryland, and then New Mexico, which last was significant.
Yeah, my dad was with the National Park Service. My mother was an amateur singer with the Mendelssohn Society Chorus in Philadelphia, but she used to play a lot of recordings at home. We didn't go to anything. We didn't have much money, so we didn't go to any events to speak of, but she used to play some classical music at home. And I didn't really see a vocal recital until I was a teenager, and I thought it was just the most boring, fakest thing I'd ever seen. And it was with Dorothy Kirsten. But then the next one I saw was with a singer, Donald Graham, and he was so wonderful and charming that I really enjoyed it. So I think what I learned then was it depends on the person and the programming. And then in New Mexico, we lived there because of Dad's work, and that was where I first saw an opera at the Santa Fe Opera because I was an usher. But I never thought doing performance for a living because it wasn't evident to me that that was a possibility. So I went to school and majored in music therapy. And then after a couple of years, I was encouraged to go to Juilliard, and then I realized I was a singer, but it really wasn't until after I got out of college that I really got serious about my technique and found a fabulous teacher who I was with until she died, and really dedicated myself more to, it was always an avocation, I think, in my brain, and lucky for me, it worked out great.
Well, who brought you down into figuring that you can earn a living as an opera singer?
You know, I kind of had to figure it out myself. My teacher was very encouraging. At that point, I had been with the Houston Opera Studio. And
who pointed you in the direction of Texas Opera Studio?
Texas Opera Studio was originally my teacher at Juilliard had called and said they were looking for somebody to sing Cinderella. And she had me audition in her living room for the conductor. And they hired me. And so that was my first experience. And what was funny was I felt that everybody in Texas Opera Theater was very used to performing, and I had really not done anything yet. So it was a great learning experience and made lifetime friendships on it. But mm-hmm. It was also 10 weeks of touring, and you realize what you don't know. You know, no idea until you're actually out there doing it. It was an amazing program, I'll tell you. It was very special.
And you had the great privilege of working with Carlisle Floyd.
Yes, I did. I did. I was kind of a fluke, and he had been commissioned to write this piece. This was a year after I got out of the opera studio, and he had been commissioned to write a piece for opening of a hall back east in a school, and he was hoping to use Friederike von Stade, and she wasn't free, and so he just asked me to do it, which was really sweet of him, and he trusts me with that piece, and I really am very honored. And so that worked out well, and I got it recorded. I was really thrilled because nobody else does it. And that one was A Citizen of Paradise, which is a monodrama about Emily Dickinson. Recorded that this year, and I also he had another cycle that had been written for two voices, and he combined it into one, and called Soul of Heaven, and that was recorded.
So from the opera studio in Texas, did you ever do the long line of auditions for the Met?
Oh, yeah. I never got past the first round of Met auditions. But for me, it was very much opportunities at the right time and working with the right people at the right time. And I was able to work with very influential directors and conductors who then would use me again, or the word of mouth was that if you could work with that director, then and you could work with anybody, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Very, very, very fortunate. And it just kind of built on itself. It was kind of funny how that happened.
Was that the way you got into the Met when you made your debut with them?
No, I mean, that didn't happen for a while. I remember auditioning for the Met, and it wasn't until I had quite a few successes abroad that I was hired. As a matter of fact, I think it was the night of my Paris opera debut that I got a call that the Met had decided to hire me. So that was the route you had to take, you know.
Had you done mostly trouser roles initially because of your voice?
I did a lot of carabinos, and that was it. I never had done really any other trouser role. I did a slew of Rosina in Barbara Seville. Mm-hmm. So those were the two roles that I would do everywhere. I think I did one handle pants role, but that was it. And I have to be grateful for the role of Carabino because it was such a foot in the door and you got noticed, which was kind of funny. You know, it's not fair to the other people in the opera because Carabino is so cute and he gets talked about and he doesn't do that much, but at the end, people really are charmed by that character. And so, you know, the other singers sometimes work their butts off and then you come out for your bow and you get all these kudos. It's really actually kind of funny. I feel bad for the Susanna because Susanna really sings all night long.
But I would have loved to have heard you as Adalgisa or Dido because those two roles for me, did you have a chance to sing Adalgisa more than once? And who was your Norma?
Yeah, my first Adalgisa, let me think. My first Adalgisa was in Seattle with Carol Van Ness and then Jamie. My very first was in 1988, and I was 3 months pregnant, and it was in Monte Carlo with Shirley Barrett.
That must have been quite a performance.
That was quite something, let me tell you. And she was incredibly gracious and incredible to work with. And then it wasn't again until, I think, 93 or 94 that I did it with Carol.
Yeah.
And then Carol and I did it quite often. We did it in Houston, then we did it in Paris twice. and also with Jane Eaglin. I did it in Paris. It's so much fun. I wish I could have done it more, actually. I really enjoyed that, and the Donizetti stuff, like the thing I did with Joan Sutherland, the Anna Bolena, was another one I really enjoyed, and I would have loved to have continued on that bel canto path. That was in Houston, and then we recorded it with Joan Sutherland, and then I did it at the Royal Opera with her.
Wow.
Which was so cool. Very fortunate to work with Joan Sutherland and Richard Bonning. You know, I always look back, I think, wow, they were hiring this kid, basically. You know, what were they doing? Why were they hiring me? But they were so sweet and so generous. And really, I until she died, I would hear from her at Christmas time. And just an incredibly generous person.
It's lovely to hear things like that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And now, do you sing, teach, or?
I do both. I sing 2000 to 2012. I was full-time in academia, but also singing. So I do maybe one or two operas a year now. I used to do only opera, you know, and now I do a lot more recitals and try to do special projects. I love chamber music. And then the longer I was in academia, I was getting fewer offers, and I think some people thought I'd just quit. So now I'm no longer in academia, and sure enough, I'm getting more offers. So I'll be back at the Met in the fall, of all things Marcellina and Figaro, as opposed to Cherubino, which is kind of cute in a way, and it's with Levine again, so it's kind of a full circle thing.
So what turned you on to women composers? Was that something that you suddenly realized that there were more than anybody knew who were writing wonderful music?
Pretty much, and I'm always looking. As a matter of fact, I was kind of on the hunt for the American 19th century Clara Schumann American, and I can't find one. It's really interesting. And then I started to think, well, how come they existed abroad, but why wasn't there one over here? But there wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of popular parlor song composers. It's all women composers. Well, Clara Schumann, some songs, Alma Mahler, Lily Boulanger, who's a really wonderful composer who died quite young, Rebecca Clark, who's really a fabulous British composer that, for her time, I think she was one of the most famous composers. And she also wrote a lot for violin because she was a violinist. But she did write songs. And then Libby Larson, who wrote a cycle for me that I premiered. And so I'm doing that cycle. It's kind of a funny group of songs. I love all this music so much. I really do.
Did you have to do a fair amount of research yourself into, beyond the name of the composers, what they had written, whether their works were available, and how much they appealed to you?
Originally, the project started in, I guess, about 1998, and it was through a group in Chicago called Artistic Circles, which is a little nonprofit that specializes in women's topics and women's arts, and they had this idea of funding a recording, and so they had sent me stacks and stacks and stacks of music. We chose focusing on women, the phases of a woman's life. Usually I choose according to the poetry, and if it speaks to me, and then I look at the line, the vocal line. Like Clara Schumann's set, Liebst du Umschönheit, which is set by quite a few different composers, and I just didn't like her setting of it, so I don't do it anymore.
Well, that's reasonable. You have to sing what you like to sing.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I tell my students. Sing what you like or else you'll never work on it.
Suzanne Mensah, mezzo-soprano, will be at the University of Central Arkansas in Conway in residence March 5th through 7th with pianist Luis Menendez. The Mensah Menendez residency includes master classes with Luis Menendez 3 to 5 p.m. Wednesday, March the 5th. And 2 to 4 p.m. Friday, March the 7th, with Suzanne Mensah. Thursday, March the 6th, there'll be a recital by Suzanne Mensah with pianist Luis Menendez of songs by women composers at 7:30 p.m. All events in Snow Fine Arts Center Recital Hall on the UCA campus. Free and open to the public. The residency sponsored by the College of Fine Arts and Communication. For more information, call Professor Jarvis, 501-450-3163. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.